You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, July 12th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. I am out at a special meeting with George Soros, Hugo Chavez, Fidel Castro, and 3,000 of the scientists who did the IPBC determining that global warming exists. I took Al Gore's plane there. He lent it to me right after I got driven to the airport by Arianna Huffington. It's been quite a day for me, folks. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to leave you empty-handed. On the program today, I didn't understand what Higgs boson was. I didn't know how to pronounce Higgs boson. It's actually Higgs boson, but I didn't know how to pronounce it. That was corrected for me right before the interview by Steven Weinberg, an American theoretical physicist who happened to win the Nobel laureate in physics for his contributions to electromagnetic interaction between elementary particles. I'm not sure if you understand that, but even if you didn't, you will enjoy this interview with Steven Weinberg, who talks about the importance and what Higgs boson is, the discovery of, and what the importance of the Higgs boson particle, and also the importance of big science. And later in the interview, he really does talk about what has changed in society, the implications of our not funding big science. So, if you like science, if you like just sort of a talk on what's changed in our society that we no longer support the pursuit of knowledge and the value it leads to society, you're going to enjoy this interview. Also, following that, just to make it a little more schizophrenic, I have an interview that I did with Forrest Brown of the PCCC at Netroots Nation. Short interview afterwards. So stick around for that as well. But now here is Nobel laureate in physics, Steven Weinberg. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I am Sam Cedar on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Steven Weinberg. He is an American theoretical physicist, the Nobel laureate in physics for his contributions with Abdus Salam and Sheldon Glashow to the unification of the weak force and electromagnetic interaction between elementary particles. I'm not 100% sure I know exactly what that means, but I appreciate your joining us.
Thank you.
So I wanted to speak. You wrote in May in the New York Times Review.
New York Review of Books.
New York Review of Books, a piece, The Crisis of Big Science, anticipating the potential discovery of Higgs boson, which I want to thank you for telling me how to pronounce properly. Can you give us some history? First off, can you tell us what the difference between what is big science?
Big science is what you see in the laboratories like CERN outside of Geneva, where this new particle is discovered. It's science at a level that really surpasses the ability of individuals or in specific universities to support, has to be supported by government. It includes high-energy physics, for example. These accelerators cost billions of dollars. Anything you do in space is big science. Space is very expensive. Sometimes it isn't science at all. We do things in space by sending astronauts up, which usually doesn't have anything to do with science, but it's all expensive. Unfortunately, although great progress was made earlier in say, 50 or 75 years ago, without spending such large sums, at the frontiers of knowledge where we are now, trying to understand the laws that govern matter, trying to understand what happened in the early universe, we just have to go beyond what we've done before experimentally, and that costs a lot of money.
And let's talk about this in the context of Higgs boson, because you basically provide the history of that has taken us up to this point of sort of, I guess, filling out in physics the standard model. Can you just sort of walk us through a little bit of the science that has led us to this discovery, or I guess this, I'm not sure if it's proper to characterize it as a discovery or this sort of, I guess, observation?
Well, I can give it a try. We have a pretty good theory of elementary particles and the forces that act on them. It's called the standard model. An essential part of the standard model is a symmetry, like a family relationship between two kinds of force. The electromagnetic force, which is pretty familiar, it's responsible for light, among other things, and the weak nuclear force, which is much less familiar, but is responsible, among other things, for the first step in the chain of nuclear reactions that gives energy to the sun. So it's very important to us, although we're not aware of it in everyday life. There, in the standard model, there is these forces appear the same way. The equations, at the level of the equations, you can hardly tell the difference between them. But there is a big difference in what we observe. The photon, the particle that carries the electromagnetic force, has no mass. It travels at the speed of light. The particles that carry the weak nuclear force are very heavy, more than almost 100 times as heavy as the hydrogen atom. So although the symmetry itself is well tested, we have to face the problem. Something is breaking the symmetry. Something is causing these particles to appear so different in the laboratory. And what is it? Well, there are lots of ideas about that. In 1967-68, I and independently the late Abdus Salam explored a possibility which had already been explored on a mathematical level by earlier authors, in particular by a whole bunch of people, including Peter Higgs. Altogether, there were half a dozen people, that what you have are, they weren't thinking in terms of the weak weak in electromagnetic forces. They were just exploring what's mathematically possible in general. Salam and I proposed a specific theory in which the symmetry between the weak and electromagnetic forces is broken by the appearance of certain kinds of field. They're called scalar fields. It's like the magnetic field in a magnet that breaks this, even though the equations that govern the iron atoms in a magnet don't distinguish one direction from another. This magnetic field points in a particular direction. It breaks that symmetry. In the same way, these scalar fields, they don't point in any particular direction in space, but they do act to break the symmetry between the weak and the electromagnetic forces, and they give the particles that carry the weak force the very large mass. They incidentally give mass to all the other particles of the Standard Model. Well, how do you test an idea like that? The general idea seemed to work very well, but how do you know that it's these new kinds of scalar fields, which we've never observed, that are doing the job of breaking the symmetry? Well, as had been observed in the earlier work by Higgs and company and even earlier people, a typical consequence of this kind of theory is that you get a new kind of particle as an observable particle that you could actually hope to find in the laboratory. Again, they didn't consider anything specific because they weren't proposing a specific theory. For Salam and me, we were able to predict a particular kind of particle, electrically neutral, highly unstable, and like a knuckleball in baseball without any spin. Which makes it unique among the elementary particles. And this is the particle that has come to be called the Higgs boson. It looks like the new particle that was discovered at CERN is just this Higgs boson. We need to do more work, or rather they, the experimentalists, need to do more work to pin down that that's what it really is. But I'm guessing that that's what it is. And I think most physicists are guessing that that's what it is. It's been a long wait, but we seem to have it at last.
And what are the implications of having, isolated it or being able to observe this particle?
Well, the main implication is to confirm the theory that we've had now since 1967 of how the forces that act on elementary particles work, the so-called Standard Model. It's confirming the missing piece of the Standard Model, which hadn't yet been confirmed. It's filling out our understanding of the laws of nature.
And this is something, and as it ties into the idea of big science, this is something that simply could not have been done any other way. You can have people sort of figuring out or at least contemplating the theoretical existence of this particle. But to actually observe it, you need to have some type of investment in what is a massive collider. I mean, just give us a little bit of that sort of, a history of the building of these colliders.
Well, you're quite right. I mean, theory, the sort of thing I do is cheap. I just sit at my desk working with paper and I earn my salary, but that doesn't take billions of dollars, unfortunately. The Higgs particle, as it's been observed, weighs a little over 130 times as much as a hydrogen atom. You can't produce, according to Einstein's E equals mc squared, to produce that much mass in a single particle, you need an awful lot of energy. Where do you get that energy? Well, you get that energy by colliding known particles, particles called protons, which you find in ordinary atomic nuclei, together. They collide head on. after being accelerated to this very high energy, high enough to produce the Higgs particles. How do you accelerate them? Well, you have to send them round and around in a ring, keeping them on track using superconducting magnets while they gradually build up speed. They're sort of like surfers riding on electromagnetic waves and being accelerated by the waves to very high energy. The tunnel in which they go round and round is crosses the border between France and Switzerland. It's about 17 miles in circumference. I think it's about 100 feet deep. I'm not sure of that. Just building the tunnel is expensive. Even more expensive is filling it with the magnets that are required to keep the particles going round and round rather than shooting off into the walls of the tunnel. Colliders like this have been built before. There's one at Fermilab outside Chicago with an energy which is maybe a third the energy of the super collider, excuse me, of the energy of the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. We had hoped to build an accelerator here in Texas, which would have been even more powerful than the one at CERN. Congress unwisely canceled that project in 1983.
The structure, I mean, at least the outer shell, I guess, is still there.
I'm sorry, 1993. I correct myself.
Yeah,
go ahead.
And the structure is actually there, isn't it? I mean, it was built, I guess, at least
Well, the tunnel was started. About a third of the tunnel was completely finished, and another third was roughly dug out. But the tunnel by itself does nothing. We started building the magnets. All the technical problems were solved. Congress was in a, somewhat like it is now, in a money-saving fit. Unfortunately, it faced a choice between the International Space Station and the this accelerator in Texas called the Superconducting Super Collider. Both were seen as Texas projects because the space station is run from Houston. Congress decided to go ahead with the space station and cancel the super collider, which was really an idiotic decision. The space station has cost 10 times as much as it would have taken to finish the super collider, and in fact 10 times the total cost of the super collider, and nothing of scientific value has come out of it. But, you know, what do you expect of a bunch of politicians?
I try and expect more. But that's
yeah, me too.
If I didn't, we wouldn't have much to talk about on a daily basis here. And so let's talk about, I mean, you go through in the piece and you really do outline the sort of the different aspects of why that funding didn't go through, but what are the implications? I mean, does it make a difference? I mean, does it make a difference that this particle was at least observed and named and confirmed this theory in Switzerland and France as opposed to Texas?
Well, as a physicist, it makes little difference to me. I'm glad to get the news, whether it's from Texas or from Switzerland. As an American, it does make a difference, and it isn't just a matter of prestige, although I think that counts. I'd like our country to be working at the forefront of learning the laws of nature at the deepest level. But I think also there's another more practical factor. In carrying out this kind of science, you're pushing technology to the limit of what we can do. You're learning how to do things. A commonly quoted example is that the physicists at CERN, in order to share information, had to develop a new way of communicating large amounts of data over the Internet, and so they invented the World Wide Web. This is an example of how the demands of big science, which in a way are like the demands of war, they really push technology as far as it can go, lead to things which are of great value to society in general. That's not why I do physics. I don't do physics because I'm trying to produce some kind of technological spin-off that will improve the economy. I do it because I want to learn about the way the world works. But for the public, thinking about spending all this money, I think that is an important factor.
And where, like, what is the next frontier? I mean, if we had had this conversation a couple of years ago, you may have said at that time the frontier really is identifying that Higgs boson. Assuming that this is what they have observed and found and isolated, what is the next frontier in terms of physics?
Oh, there are so many puzzles that face us now. We don't know which ones are ripe for solution. We're working on all of them. One puzzle is the dark matter. Astronomers tell us that 5/6 of the mass of the universe is some kind of particle that's different from anything we've observed, different from any particle described by our present standard model. We need to know what that is. It may be that dark matter particles will be created at CERN. That's probably the most exciting thing that CERN could do. But we don't know that's going to happen. There are varieties of possible kinds of particle that might make up the dark matter. Some of them could be created at CERN. Others couldn't. We don't know which one is right. There are other problems. I mean, there's a long-standing problem that goes back decades and decades, how to bring gravitation, which after all is the most familiar of all the forces, into the same mathematical framework as the other forces. When you try to make a theory of gravity similar to the theory of the strong and weak and electromagnetic forces in the standard model, you get into mathematical difficulties, you get paradoxes. It doesn't work. That's a theoretical problem. I don't see any way experimentally of getting a handle on that, but it's possible that experiments at a place like the Large Hadron Collider might turn up a clue. In fact, there is one possible kind of clue. There is a symmetry that goes beyond any of the symmetries in the standard model called supersymmetry, which puts particles together into much bigger families than the ones we have in the standard model. And it predicts the existence of all kinds of new particles. If this is verified by discovering some of these new particles, they're called superparticles, at CERN, that might give us a big clue as to how to deal with gravitation. But we don't know. With the Higgs boson, that was something we could expect to discover. To a certain extent, both the super collider here in Texas and the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland were planned with the idea of discovering the Higgs boson, because it was something that we really were pretty sure was there, and if it wasn't there, we had theorems that told us there would be something else similar that we would discover. In a way, we knew that this was an area we were going to illuminate with these accelerators. It turned out that worked at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. These other problems, we don't know. We really don't know what kind of experiment is going to tell us what the dark matter is. For example, experimentalists are busy trying to catch dark matter particles hitting the Earth from outer space and observe them in laboratories deep underground where you're shielded from other ordinary particles that would get in the way of your observations. That might work. Some people think they've already seen signs of these dark matter particles. So that would be a clue to a fundamental issue coming from, it's still big science that it costs a lot to put huge tanks of liquid and detectors and machinery down in these big caverns and wait for years looking for signs of dark matter particles. It's still big science, but it's a different kind of big science. And they may actually have discovered the dark matter particle, although it's too soon to tell. So I don't know the answer. I don't know what's going to be the next big thing.
What do they
do? May be that...
What do they do at CERN now? I mean, if they've had this agenda to, you know, and these colliders were built with this notion of,
they have a pretty good idea of what they're going to do. They're going to shut down the accelerator for a while, and they're going to improve the magnets to the point where the accelerator can operate at the energy for which it was originally designed, which instead of about 3,000 or 3,500 times the energy and the mass of a hydrogen atom, it's going to be 7,000 times. And so in other words, roughly double the energy. And that will give them a much greater reach for discovering new kinds of particles. They're also going to do everything they can to verify that this new particle, which seems very definitely to be a new particle that they've discovered, is the predicted Higgs boson. The standard model, the electroweak theory, predicts all the properties of the Higgs particle except its mass. Well, now we know the mass because the thing has been observed and the mass has been measured. And so you can predict all kinds of things about how this particle will be created and even more important, how it decays. And CERN will doubtless go through a lot of work verifying these predictions. Of course, it would be very interesting if these predictions aren't verified and it turns out this is something a little different from the predicted Higgs particle. We'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, I'm struck. I mean, as a scientist and you hear that... You speak of this being the Higgs boson particle is almost assuredly is. How do you? I'm just curious from a sort of almost like a very practical standpoint. Like, how do you come to that conclusion? Do you see their research and see that everything is it simply that you have confidence in their methodology? I'm just curious as to how you sort of get your sense of whether or not they've actually found it.
Well, I'm not looking over their shoulders, but I know the sort of thing they're doing, and I know the kind of observations they're making, and I know how it fits into the theory. For example, the theory predicts that these particles should be produced, the Higgs particle should be produced in collisions at a certain rate. So you expect to see a certain number of them. Well, that's roughly the number they're seeing. The theory predicts that these particles should be electrically neutral and highly unstable. Well, the new particle is electrically neutral and highly unstable. The theory predicts that one of the ways it should decay is into two photons. Photons are particles of light. Well, that's one of the ways it is seen to decay, and so on. None of that has the kind of, well, I could say other things. Higgs particles have a subtle effect, even when they're not created as in the laboratory, they have a subtle indirect effect on other things, like the effect the mass of other particles. Those calculations have been done and have indicated that the Higgs particle, which would be producing those effects, would have a mass similar to the mass that has been observed. So it all fits together. It doesn't, however, fit together with the kind of precision that you hope for to say this has really been buttoned down. I mean, for example, the particles that carry the weak nuclear force, the W and Z, have a mass which is predicted to better than a percent. And that's the mass that's observed. So with that kind of agreement between theory and experiment, you really know that what you're seeing is the thing that's described by the theory. We don't yet have that kind of precision nailing down that this is the Higgs boson. But, you know, it looks like a Higgs boson, it walks like a Higgs boson, it talks like a Higgs boson. That's probably a Higgs boson.
And when they essentially refit this collider with magnets that will create that much more activity, will they now sit back and just simply measure the relative phenomena that they observe and begin to develop new theories? I mean,
they're going to be searching for all kinds of things that theorists have been talking about, like superparticles that I mentioned earlier, like dark matter particles that I mentioned earlier. They're going to be searching for these things. They're also going to keep their eyes open for anything that might be a complete surprise. And they understand, I mean, these experimentalists understand very well our existing theory, the Standard Model, and they're going to keep their eyes out for anything that doesn't look like something that would come out of the Standard Model. They're certainly not going to spend their time doing nothing but endlessly verifying the Standard Model. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is important to verify that this new particle is that last missing piece of the Standard Model, the Higgs boson, but they're going to be doing a lot of other things. I mean, that's what we're all hoping for. We're all hoping that they'll discover something that goes beyond the Standard Model, either superparticles or dark matter particles or something we haven't even thought of yet. And we'll be very disappointed if they don't, but there's no way of knowing.
Right. Well, lastly,
that's what makes it so exciting.
Lastly, I just wanted to you ended your piece talking about how, you know, big science necessarily competes with other I guess needs of society in terms of competing for dollars. And you have a very, an interesting perspective, and one that is sort of very comprehensive. You talk about a lot of the sort of the failures that we see in society, whether it's the SEC not having enough staff to win cases against corporations, or not enough drug rehabilitation centers, just and so on. Just tell me, if you will, like where you feel like science fits in, and the importance of scientists who are seeking funding and seeking support for big science, where they fit in almost as citizens in the context of the societies in which they want to get resources for big science.
Well, science is a public good. A public good is something that is done not for the benefit of the people who are doing it, the way a corporation does things because it wants to make a profit, but that serves the public as a whole, like police protection, fire protection, national defense, public health, and so on. These are all public goods, and science is one of them. Some science, of course, is done for immediate practical purposes by corporations that are going to use the results in new technology or in medicines that they're going to sell. But then the kind of science I've been talking about, the kind of science that's done at CERN, for example, doesn't produce things that will earn a profit. It has to be done by governments serving society as a whole. My perspective is that it's going to be a tragedy if different people who are pushing different public goods start fighting with each other over a limited amount of public support. I think our society, I'm thinking about America, but I suspect the same is increasingly true in Europe, is rich in private goods and poor in public goods. There are many things that, I mean, we spend enormous amounts of money on things that it seems to consumer electronics, fast food, computer games, expensive cars. We spend a lot of money on consumer goods, which don't seem to me to be filling the kind of urgent need that we have. in education and health and in defending our borders and in pushing back the frontiers of knowledge. And I would like to see us switch our emphasis away from private goods toward public goods. I don't think this actually will mean that we will live impoverished lives, because right now our society has, we're in somewhat of a recession, which means that we have more of a capability of producing private goods than people can afford to buy. By shifting the balance of our economy toward public goods, we'll be putting money in people's hands and reinvigorate the private sector. Furthermore, a lot of the spending on public goods, whether it's improving the patent office or improving our transportation infrastructure, improving our education, actually goes to make our society more productive. So I think the emphasis on low taxation, small government, is helping to make us a poorer country, a country in which it's less rewarding to live. And I would like to see our economy swivel toward a greater emphasis on public spending, which means higher taxes, especially on the rich, especially on investment income. And, you know, I could run on this as a political platform, and I would probably only get votes from my close relatives. But
well, you'd get my vote.
Okay. Maybe, there are four of us.
Well, maybe I'll run your campaign. But do you think this is something? Has something changed in society? I mean, do you see? I mean, is this a Have you witnessed? I mean, you were first sort of theorizing about this Higgs boson in the late '60s, mid '60s, and maybe earlier.
Late '60s is right.
Have you noticed a change in the way that society perceives both science, but that may be sort of reflected in a broader change in values of society?
Yeah, I do, and I'm not the only person that's seen this. I mean, in the 1950s, we had a Republican president, Dwight Eisenhower, who carried out an enormous program of public spending for the interstate highway system. We've had Republican presidents like Richard Nixon, who established the Environmental Protection Agency. We've had in the past a sense that there are things that are needed for society as a whole that can best be done by government and that should be done by government, even if it requires diverting funds from the private sector, especially in the form of taxes on high incomes. I don't think I pay high enough taxes, for example. That has changed. We really now seem to be in a kind of piggish mood, a mood of I've got mine and I'm going to keep mine and keep your hands off it, and I don't care about the other guy. Here in Texas, the governor has just said everyone in Texas can get health care when they need it, and what he means is that if you're not insured, you can go to the emergency room. That's a kind of meanness. You can't get help with a chronic disease by going to the emergency room every time you have a troublesome symptom. There's a kind of meanness in society now, which I find terribly disturbing. I guess it's not entirely new. It's the sort of thing that was common in the late 19th century. But it's new, I think, in my life, and I don't like it.
I share that sentiment, and I appreciate your taking the time to talk to us about this and educating me on this uh, this impressive, I guess, discovery. Is that how I would characterize it, as a discovery? Or, I mean,
yeah, it's a discovery. It's a very nice discovery. It's a discovery of a new particle, and I hope it's the new particle that we've been thinking about for many decades now, the Higgs particle.
And when will you be sure?
Oh, there isn't any one moment. You know, it gradually gets more and more definite. We don't. There's no point where we take a vote. Well, in a way, there is. There's a booklet of particle properties put out every couple of years by the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory in California, and they list all the known particles with their properties. And I imagine this particle is going to appear. Well, there's no question it's a new particle. It will appear. And at a certain point, they're going to start calling it the Higgs particle.
Steven Weinberg, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time today.
Nice talking to you. Bye-bye.
Continuing our coverage at Netroots Nation 2012, with me now is Forrest Brown of the PCCC. Forrest, what do the C's stand for? And in fact, what does the P stand for?
Hi, Sam. So the P stands for Progressive, and the C's are the Progressive Change Campaign Committee.
And what do you guys do?
So we work on national elections to help elect progressives to Congress, and we also work on issue activism to try and pass progressive policies in Congress and now at the state level as well.
And was PCCC involved in I guess, I don't know if I would call it a protest or a protest. You can tell me when Eric Schneiderman spoke here at Netroots Nation. Eric Schneiderman, of course, the Attorney General of New York. Was PCCC involved in that?
So we have, for a long time, encouraged Eric and worked with Eric to hold Wall Street accountable. And when he was here on Thursday, we continued that by encouraging him to jail the bankers, and we printed up some sweet signs that said "jail the bankers." And I think Eric acknowledged that in the speech. That's something that he wants to do. And he also acknowledged that politics is about the grassroots pressuring the politicians to do that. And that's something that I think our signs were about. And it's challenging to to investigate and hold Wall Street accountable, but it's something we're committed to. It's something we think Democrats and progressives need to do. And hopefully Eric can continue working on that and work towards actually charging and convicting Wall Street bankers who broke the law.
Tell me about that. Give me your sense of that dynamic. I mean, because it's not necessarily something that I think is incredibly obvious to people. Eric Schneiderman, who in many respects, and maybe that's turned a little bit in the recent months since his signing on to the mortgage fraud deal, but considered a at least favorable, if not a darling of the left. And he's at a probably, one would think, pretty close to as he could get a convention where he's going to have the most amount of allies, at least in a national sort of activist way. Explain to me more about the dynamic about doing this type of protest.
Sure. Well, so I wouldn't call it a protest. I would say it's a show of support for the work that Eric is doing and that we want him to do. And, that is to investigate and hold Wall Street accountable. And, Eric mentioned in his speech that, the sort of famous FDR quote where, he tells Sidney Hillman and the unions and, progressive leaders during the 1930s that if you want me to do something, you're going to have to push me. You have to make me do it. And that's exactly right, that, while Eric is on the right side on this and has, has made big progress as far as ensuring that there is an investigation task force to investigate the banks, we have to push him the next step. And the reason is because politicians are under a lot of pressure, and, they're under a lot of pressure from banks, they're under a lot of pressure from centrists, and we have to push back. And, it's sort of a bear hug. It's a friendly hug, and but also kind of pushing them, because, you know, we have to generate that pressure in order to give them the space to act and to do the right thing, and which in this case is to investigate and prosecute Wall Street.
Yeah, it's that space to act, which is the interesting dynamic, because, of course, there can be a tremendous amount of pressure put on him behind closed doors, or as soon as he walks off that podium. But by doing it in public, it allows him to take that pressure, and it allows him to use that pressure against him. I'm sorry. It allows him to use the pressure that's being used against him in justifying certain moves that he may do as he's going after the bank.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think you even saw sort of the beginning of that in the speech when Eric, you know, sort of saw the signs and acknowledged the chant for prosecute the banks and jail Wall Street. You know, he acknowledged that in a friendly manner and said, that's exactly the sort of thing we need to do. So that's exactly right. You know, it gives him the space to act. And that's the role of progressive groups like ours, is to continue to push politicians to do the right thing, because if we stop pushing, there's no one else who's pushing them to do things like hold Wall Street accountable.
And to what extent does the PCCC function like the Grover Norquist contingency of the Republicans? In other words, you had guys who... They now sort of have morphed into the Tea Party, but a guy who's considered Tea Party candidate, Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania, is now the senator there. But he ran a long time, or often, I think at least twice, with sort of the backing of Grover Norquist, who's his organization, and they were they're credited with also taking out guys like Lincoln Chafee, sort of creating, I guess, a more ideologically pure or consistent Republican Party. And to what extent is the PCCC sort of serving that role on the left?
Sure. So, you know, we think primaries are important, and they're the most effective way to make sure that the people going to Congress who are Democrats are progressives. And so we do work this year. We've worked in open seat primaries, and in the past we've also worked, for example, in Arkansas. We worked with Bill Halter, who almost beat Blanche Lincoln in the primary there. And I think, you know, what the Halter example suggests is that primaries work not only in electoral sense, but that primary also resulted in us passing Wall Street reform in a much more progressive form of Wall Street reform than we would have otherwise.
Because Blanche Lincoln had to actually sort of address one of her major criticisms, because she was under a political threat.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, primaries enable push politicians to, they have to move to the left. And, you know, it's something we've been seeing this year, is that, you know, in these open seat primaries, everyone wants to call themselves the progressive. And I think that's a victory. It's a small victory, but, you know, when all the politicians in Democratic primary saying, okay, we need to protect Social Security and Medicare, no cuts, that's a step forward. And it's a sign that, you know, our approach to primaries is working.
Does the PCCC have a strategy on holding the line when it comes to no cuts in Social Security? One of the things that people are talking about quite a bit here is a concern that going into the lame duck session, the Democrats don't have a cohesive, coherent policy to deal with the fiscal cliff, and that one of the things that are will be on the chopping block will be Social Security.
Yeah, this is something we've heard from for the last 2 or 3 years. And, you know, it's always disappointing when Democrats start being squishy on Social Security and Medicare. But, you know, we've been really consistent about holding them accountable. And, you know, last year we pushed the president on this. We pushed Democrats on this by, you know, sort of a combination of running TV ads, by using, you know, online activism, and then offline activism, making calls into congressional offices and that sort of thing. This is a big priority for us, and, you know, as this fight comes up, we're going to continue to play a part in holding Democrats accountable, making sure that we hold the line on Social Security and Medicare. It's vital to our country, and it's something that we're going to continue working hard on.
How can people get involved with the PCCC?
Yeah, so our website is boldprogressives.org. And you can sign up there and stay in the loop for our activism in elections, Social Security, Medicare, and Wall Street accountability.
Do people organize on a state-by-state basis with the PCCC?
Just recently, we started doing state work with we hired this great organizer a couple of months ago, and he's been stepping up our state game. So, you know, that's something that we're getting increasingly involved in, and should have lots of exciting things in the next few months.
Do you choose specific states in which to start?
So our approach is to look at sort of blue states that we think are, you know, we can make a big difference in. They have maybe a Democratic legislator, but they're not passing progressive policies. And so, you know, by stepping in, by putting pressure on weak Democrats in the states, we can, you know, achieve progressive policies there. And we can also build a backbench of progressive leaders at the state level that can one day be run for Congress.
Forrest Brown of the PCCC, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sam.